Hi, I'm Mike Seymour, and welcome to the VFX Show. And I'm joined by two good friends this week. Kristen Martin, how are you?
I'm doing fine.
And Jason Wingrove.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
Good, man. So this week we're going to look at The Abyss because
I begged you to.
Well, that, and because we know that if we stare into the abyss long enough, it'll stare back at us. we're going to be doing this. It's sort of like, I kind of think of these as our sort of Cinefex retrospectives, because this is a great chance for us to look at films that just we loved from time gone by when we've got a break between great films. And there are some great films coming up. We have some terrific stuff, including Star Trek, that we'll be doing in weeks to come. But this week we want to look back at a film from the 80s. I think about, 88, 86, 89?
1989, yeah. Yes.
And I've got to say, this was James Cameron for me at, one of his, because he has a lot, but one of his best films ever. What did you guys think, Kristen?
I would definitely agree. I think this is one of James Cameron's best films. Now, when I was doing research for this show, this is the first time I've actually seen the special edition. I had only seen the theatrical version up to this point.
You've only seen the short version.
The short version. So it was really great to see all the additional material.
Which is still good.
Yeah. So I really liked it. Great underwater camera work, the lighting, the visual effects, the sound design. It's just all around great.
And you, Jace? I mean, you really do like it, right?
Yeah, like absolutely. I mean, somebody asked me what my favorite Cameron film was the other day, and I just couldn't actually sort of pick it. But having seen this one again, I think this is probably close to being it. It's, I love it on so many levels. It's so atmospheric. It's such a breakthrough film, but it's not. I love it because, again, you can't really see it as an effects film. It's such a great, just piece of filmmaking in general. Some fantastic characters and the whole sort of pressure cooker atmosphere and just brilliant performances. And I also love it from the fact that it's such an effort of filmmaking, such an amazing, epic journey to get the thing made. I know you should switch that part of you off when you're sort of watching the film, but I can't. It's the whole making of is embedded in the film itself for me. It's awesome.
Well, of course, our regular co-host David Stropinis is on James Cameron's new film, so obviously he can't talk about James Cameron while working for James Cameron. Though I must admit, I actually got asked that question, what was your favourite James Cameron film, by David, who was kind enough to ask me that question. So when I visited Avatar, I got a copy of the script signed by James of my favourite, which happened to be Aliens.
Awesome.
But I would say that I just think Sigourney's performance in that tipped me over the edge on that. But I do think this is absolutely one of his best. And I agree with you, Jason. It's almost impossible to watch this film without taking into account the heroic nature of the filmmaking that was involved. Let's discuss some of the background of the film before we get into it. But I should say that for my money today, I'm going to focus pretty much on the special edition because, it's... I think it's worth seeing. It's longer. It's nearly 3 hours, about 170 minutes, but it's obviously got more special effects in it, and maybe special effects at a level, or visual effects at the level that they were more happy with a bit more time and money to do it.
That's the version of the DVD I have. How much longer is it, I wonder?
I think it's gone from 140 to 170 minutes. Is that right, Kristen?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Yeah. Wow. So the film was made, and most of you probably know this, but it's worth recounting, that it was made with 40% of the production being actually filmed in what was then the largest freshwater filming tank in the world. And this was, famously a converted reactor containment building from an uncommissioned nuclear power plant. And if you want to get some really great detailed information on this, by the way, I mentioned it a little earlier, Cinefex issue... 89, which is the 39th issue of Cinefex, is completely devoted to this film. And I just can't recommend Cinefex strongly enough. And this particular one was written by Don Shea, the publisher and founder. And it's just a great article. And they go into some great depths about how they found this, specially converted reactor, or rather how they converted the reactor they found, because it really was not in any state for filming when they found it. Did you read up any of that background story, Jase?
Yeah, one of my favorite sort of stories is before they started production, obviously they had to, it's like 200 foot wide sort of thing, and I don't know how deep it is, but it's like
55 feet deep.
It's like 3 million litres or 3 million gallons.
Actually, just... I've got that stat for you as well. Oh, 7.5 million gallons when fully... Okay. fully.
So this is the A tank? Cause, yeah, the B tank.
Yeah, this is
the,
A tank.
Yeah, and the B yeah. tank was 120 by 50 by 22. So definitely yeah. both were immense.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's so many filming limitations to try and... Obviously, first of all, you've got to make something that wasn't really finished, wasn't really completed as a construction. You've got to make it watertight. Then you've got to filter it, and then you've got to block out the sun, which we'll sort of touch on a little bit later. But massive, massive construction just to build, just to create somewhere to film, let alone putting stuff in there to film.
But the other one, I mean, blocking out the sun, as I said, we'll discuss that in a second, but the one that was enormous for me was they had to heat this. This was like a heated pool, because otherwise the actors and the director and the crew would get hypothermia. But they had to heat it to actually 85 degrees. So think about that for a second. Like, think about your own pool, how much energy and trouble it is to heat a swimming pool.
Yeah, and the chemistry.
And how small that is, yeah. And what you needed to have was something that was probably clearer than most people's swimming pools, enormous, as in 7.5 million gallons, and the darn thing had to be not like at a luxurious 72 degrees, but a full 85 degrees. Otherwise, they couldn't have the crew working for 12 hours a day. It's just astonishing.
Yeah, that's quite amazing.
They actually spent $2.25 million before they started just building the filtration and heating units for the tanks.
It's a mammoth build. And, I guess we can touch on the... obviously, what they wanted to do with the surface of the water, not just necessarily blocking out the light, but what they had to do was actually break the surface of the water, because essentially, if you're down bottom of the, you know, go while you're listening, go to the bottom of your pool. If you look up, essentially it's like a mirror. You're looking at, you know, the surface is essentially reflective. So they essentially poured in, you know, trillions of little tiny polypropylene or little plastic balls onto the surface, kind of like, you know, like black.
They emptied their bean bags.
Black beads. So that obviously from a safety point of view, rather than just tarping it or putting something on the surface, you can come up through it safely if you need to. But obviously, yes, it basically means when you're down below looking up, you're just essentially looking up to as much of an abyss above as there is, you know, theoretically should be below.
Because Cameron had to decompress each day because he was underwater so much, and he was obviously a diver going in, but more of an amateur diver, they actually... He had to have an hour decompression. So they would actually run a watertight video split down to him so he could watch rushes in the water while he was decompressing. That is diehard.
The dedication of this. I mean, obviously...
The guy is a god.
Yeah. If you ever have any DVD in your collection, I think, and you should have, I'm sure, you know, as soon as I say this, 5 minutes later, the Blu-ray or something will come out. But definitely got to get the DVD for this show. And the making of Under Pressure, making of DVD of Abyss is just outstanding. And you really get a taste of the dedication and the dedication of Jim beyond anybody else. My favorite story is, while we're still talking about the tank, is I don't know whether in production, but maybe in pre, while they're still filling it up, one of the valves started to give way. So Jim alone was down there by the valve, you know, whatever it was, 7 million, however many trillion gigalitres of water bursting out, which basically was breaking the speed of sound as it burst out of his valve. And Jim was down there lashing it up with rags and trying to protect the water from, you know, trying to protect his tank from any further bursts. So I just... blows me away.
So this was all happening in South Carolina. And as we said, about 70% of the production was filmed underwater. And not just Cameron, who obviously we just can't say enough about, but the other actors. I mean, Ed Harris and people like that. I really like these guys. They're terrific actors.
Yeah, it's
actors.
A fantastic cast. Brilliant.
Quite a few people from Aliens, I noticed.
Brilliant chemistry, yes.
But it's great, I think, when somebody works with people and really likes them and comes back to them again. And, but they would have, they did. They had to go to the Cayman Islands, I think, for some serious deep water training before they even got on set. And then, of course, got a ton of stuff done. But it would have been one of those productions that, you know, you'd have got the tattoo at the end of it for, you know. Oh, dear.
Son of Abyss.
Wasn't Son of an Abyss. So, and the other thing that was extraordinary was just how big the build was in the tanks. And these enormous models they built in the tanks, when the water level started going down, because these things were designed to be partially sustained by the fact that they were floating in water, they had to clear the tanks sometimes because they were worried about the actual sets collapsing once they were out of the water. And of course, you know, we're talking, as they've said in the article, life and death situations with actors. And, you know, it's just not something that you should take lightly, that the Jimmy himself had a tank. He had somebody basically angeling everyone that was down there, checking their tanks and stuff so they could focus on acting, except for him. And his tank actually ran out at one point, and he had to change and do stuff underwater. And it was really, you know, had he not been experienced and such a level-headed guy, he could have easily drowned himself or come up too quickly and got the bends. But, yeah, it's pretty serious stuff.
There's a lot of developments when you're talking about the diving. Obviously, one of the main things being the full-face helmets, which I think this were developed for this film. Now, obviously, every film since has benefited from this kind of, you know, full-face diving helmet system. But essentially, for this film, they had to develop the whole full-face system, so you could obviously see the actor's face and the internal lighting system for the for the helmets, which is about the best it's ever been done. It just amazes me, the terrible in-helmet lighting that goes on so many films now. It looks like, how can people see what they're doing? They're going to be blinded by the lights inside the helmet. But this has been, you know, obviously done really well. They had to develop the whole helmet system. They had to develop the underwater tank refueling system, so you didn't actually have to go up every hour, every 45 minutes or so to refuel.
Somebody must have been going up and down a lot with cameras, because they'd had to reload the cameras.
To reload, yeah. If they could have invented an underwater reloading facility, I'm sure he would have. Nowadays, it's the kind of show you'd do digital, of course.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, the communication system, too, for the between the crew and between the actors themselves, so they could record the dialogue.
Which Jim famously thinks is an absolutely fantastic invention because it's only one way.
Yes. I must admit, I've done some directing with underwater crews on a water phone thing, you know, where everyone underwater can hear because it's being broadcast into the water.
But nobody can
answer back. Yeah, it's quite a fun way to direct. But yeah, well, those helmets, I thought one of the interesting anecdotes was that you could wear those helmets without the need to wear a full scuba gear. And because the tank was heated to a, you know, 85 degrees, he didn't actually need to wear a wetsuit to stay warm. So, in fact, Cameron would direct wearing one of those helmets, swimming trunks and a Hawaiian shirt underwater. So I thought it would have been pretty funny. I couldn't find any photos of that, but it sounded like a hoot. Let's talk about visual effects now, because, I mean, we could spend forever on just the immense coolness. Interestingly, this is one of the first productions that I'm aware of that when they put out a bid for the whole production, it just came back as far too much money. So they then split it up and got companies to bid on sort of scenes effectively. And I think they broke it up into 7 units and then they got companies to bid those out, though Cameron reserved the right to have a company awarded more than one of those sections. And from that, they got manageable bite-sized chunks, and it emerged that DreamQuest Images and ILM were the two principal houses. And actually, it wasn't ILM doing all of the stuff that one might think of today. ILM was primarily came in on the water pod, which I think was, you know, magnificent and completely made the film. But DreamQuest Images did a sensational job, and the three supervisors, John Bruno, who will go on to do amazing stuff with X-Men and stuff, and Hoyt Yeoman, and again, amazing visual effects supervisor, and of course Dennis Muren at ILM.
All icons,
and you know what a great team. I mean, the if you IMDb those three guys alone, you get pretty much the history of visual effects. So I'd like to actually discuss the pseudopod, because I think it's one of the most interesting and certainly one of the most highest profile pieces of computer animation. At that time, it really defined what was possible. And it certainly wasn't that they came to that as a fully CG from the outset. In fact, they actually looked at, I don't know if you guys read this, at doing claymation and projecting water textures on black clay. Did you read that?
I did read that, yes.
Which would have looked bloody awful.
It would have.
I'm sure.
Yeah. It's a good idea that one got thrown by the wayside.
What was interesting about that sequence was that they didn't really know how well it would go, even in the middle of once they had decided to go CGI, never really knew how successful it would be. So if you actually look at the film, that whole scene was designed so that if it didn't really work, they could just lift that entire scene out of the film, and no one would notice that was missing. So even though they thought that was the best way to go, and clearly it was, there was still then that fear that it may not look any good.
And Cam, what research did you come up with on the pseudopod?
I just thought it was interesting how they had to just document everything about the environment. So when they went to do the CGI part, that they had all the data to work from. And it's such an iconic sequence. It's just amazing. And I guess by today's standards, we're used to that sort of thing. But for the time, I just remember it being just amazing.
I think one of the things that I was amused is that the young animator that was given the job of doing that photographing of the set, which today we'd think of as an HDR, but back then the whole concept of a HDR hadn't really been articulated, was a young John Knoll.
Really?
Yeah, John was the guy that was set up to do that, and they took all those photos, as Cam said, of the set for reflections and stuff, and then they took it into their Pixar image computer.
Pixar.
Yes, to put it together. Right. And yes, in the days that Pixar was a hardware company, and they put that together, and that gave them the reflections. So, of course, as anyone on set would know, you don't tend to build a set in every direction. You tend to build a set for where the camera's going to see. So it wasn't a given that that was going to be all working fine, because, of course, you'd have lights and overhead gantries and rigs and all the stuff in a dry set that you would normally have, to be able to film. You wouldn't be filming 360 degrees and top and bottom, which, of course, is what the reflections would see.
This is, I guess, really one of those effects. I mean, obviously back then, this is something where they would have had to build software to do it. I mean, the Pixar was around, but they would have had to create, a way of doing it. I just love the thinking that let's do this thing. We have no idea how we're going to do it, rather than, oh, we've got this cool plug-in. What can we do to throw into the story to do it? I just love that sort of reverse thinking. Think of a fantastic thing to do, and then we have to work out, okay, how the hell do we pull this off?
One of the things I love about doing these shows is you get to research the old school techniques they did to solve a bunch of stuff. And we're definitely going to come up with some of those in a second. But the other thing that I love about these shows is you come across little gems. And one of them was, where the door is slammed by the somewhat psychotic army guy, and the water obviously goes from being in a gelatinous state to being free-form water and drops. Did you guys read how that was done?
No, I didn't. And because even on the DVD, there's a shot-by-shot breakdown of it before the effects and after the effects. And even in the background plates, it doesn't show that waterfall effect.
They do talk about it a little bit in the text commentary. It's just real brief. It's a few lines about that. And they mentioned that it was the only digitally composited shot in the film.
Well, the way they did it was that they were intending on having basically a digital, obviously, a pseudopod, and then they were going to release water from being held above, but they were going to do a split screen, and the split screen would be effectively a wipe device that would turn the pseudopod we wiped off as the water came down through shot.
Right.
Though as they were starting to do this, John suggested that he and his brother had written a little piece of software for doing some hand painting stuff. And his brother's software, this little piece of Photoshop software, and in fact he did that, and that was the digitally composited piece on a very early version of Photoshop, and I just thought that was a great gem. I think was kind of interesting to me was that ILM had done work on Star Trek for the face scanning stuff, and it was the same base technology that they used for doing the ends of the pseudopod when it met the principal cast at the in the sleeping quarters or the nuclear reactor room.
Right, because this is, I guess,
the bomb room.
This is, I guess, the first time that people had really done that sort of 3D scanning, which now you can probably do with your eyesight camera off your Mac.
Well, it worked much better than it did in Star Trek, because in Star Trek they had, their heads coming up through the clouds, and I thought the whole thing looked really hokey. but in this, I thought it looked really, really good, and definitely... the other thing was this was primarily done with locked-off shots, because in those days it really made a big difference to have locked-off shots, and it just didn't feel like locked-off shots.
They mentioned in the text commentary that they used a cyberware scanner, and they had to especially do extra scans of the female lead for the different facial expressions.
Yeah, because it was primarily designed for stills, and so to get her a range of expressions where she does the smile and stuff was a sequence still, and it was just a huge achievement. I don't know if you guys ever saw this. I certainly did. When this went to air once, back before they did the special edition, they had obviously a 4x3 version of this sequence.
Yeah.
And in the 4x3 version, when they transferred it for TV, they literally came in from the sides and went up and down in the middle.
Right.
But ILM never bothered rendering below the cutoff for the scope. So you would actually have this enormous line where the pseudopod started in the swimming pool shot. Mm. Like there'd be water in the swimming pool, big line, pseudopod, and going up through the door. And I looked at it and I was like, what is that line? And dawned on me what it was, that was the 4x3 cutoff, rather the film cutoff suddenly being revealed when they went to the wider 4x3 aspect ratio. And the git that did the telecine transfer was too stupid to understand what they were doing. But
oh, that's just horrendous.
I think that's never been seen again since. But yeah, no, I think that was cool. I think one of the things that as a kid when I saw this just absolutely fascinated me was the rat in the oxygen breathing liquid.
Can I jump back for a sec to the tentacle for moment? Just what I'm putting the director's hat on for a minute. But what makes it great and what makes it a great scene and like the standout scene of the film almost, it's the liquid metal T-1000 for this film, is that the effect is great because of the performances around it. It's their wonder at seeing it. It's seeing their faces mimicked in it. It's these fantastic reactions from Mary Elizabeth and from Ed. It makes it so memorable, their reactions to something that obviously doesn't exist. It's like that first time Dr. Grant sees Brontosauruses in Jurassic Park. It's his wonder. Oh my god, sure. God, right. Gobsmacked, dropping to your knees reaction that sells it in so much. And that's
the
what
killer double take.
Yeah, so for me that's obviously 50% of what makes that scene so fantastic and what made it such a success, I guess, is the reactions around it. And one of those first few films where people actually had to, you know, react to nothing or react to a piece of air conditioning ducting, wasn't it?
Right, that's what it was, yeah.
Again, on the DVD, if you get the DVD, there's some fantastic outtakes of, props guys snaking the spooky air conditioning hose through the hatches and through.
Well, I will say The Abyss won the 1990 Oscar for Best Visual Effects.
Well,
So it bloody should have, yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go back to my rat.
Go to your rat.
My mouse in the liquid.
Oh, he's
so
a rat.
When I watched that, I was just fascinated at A, how they did it. And then I read that they did it for real.
And
they did,
out.
Right.
And they did I it for totally real. Flipped.
Not only did they do it for real, but they did it to like six different rats.
And they all survived.
Indeed,
because
they
in
did.
Fact, it is a viable thing to do. So for those of you that just not 100% up with us, in this scene when they're showing how they're later going to have Ed Harris's character survive at enormous depths where oxygen would implode your lung system under the pressure of deep diving, they show a liquid breathing system, which is something that Cameron had come across when he was like 17. And it was a system of actually having a liquid that was fully aerated, and your lungs would be able to actually remove the air from the liquid, because the theory is, of course, in the womb you would, you know, breathe happily and have liquid in the lungs, and so humans were actually designed to be able to do that. And if you could pull air out of the liquid, then you'd be able to have no air gas, as it were, going down your throat and in your lungs, and you'd just have this liquid that would come out. Now, of course, anyone that thinks about this for a second will realize that while it may be possible, it's also going to be bloody hard work, because you'll be pushing a viscous liquid through your lungs and through your throat, as opposed to air, which quite frankly is easy to swallow.
It would be freaky. So obviously in the movie, Ed Harris doesn't actually do this technique, but obviously the rat really did and went through it for real.
Well, they perfected the technique actually from the initial thing that Cameron got intrigued with, which actually led to the short story that led to The Abyss.
Right.
They perfected that by having a much better system for having the oxygen in the liquid, which actually made it 20 times easier to extract the oxygen. The problem was actually the carbon dioxide when you come out the other side, because you're not only bringing oxygen in, but you're trying to put carbon dioxide out, and you can obviously die from carbon dioxide poisoning.
Right.
And here the problem was that the system that they came up for collecting the carbon dioxide out of your lungs and then being able to get it out into the liquid, which is similar to the way that air is scrubbed in systems for actually involved a carcinogenic process.
Mm, yeah.
And so, yes, you could do this, but you'd be basically filling up an actor's lungs with something that was known to be a known carcinogen.
So at least you wouldn't die of CO2 poisoning.
No, no.
later.
You would die of
something else.
Cancer. But, yeah, so in the later scenes, that was a simulated effect. But there's no reason for that liquid to be pink. That was just done for creative reasons on set to make it the audience understand that, that was the liquid he saw earlier.
It's impressive. And what's important to look at, again, jumping to production, is that every time you see Ed Harris underwater when he is in the liquid breathing apparatus, he has no air in his suit. He's just got a flip-up visor on his suit. Every time he's acting, and the whole time where he's being dragged on the trench, descending into the abyss, he has no air. So I just find it absolutely astounding.
Yeah, but nobody cares about the cancer in the rats. I'm sorry, you just skipped over that, right? There's a whole generation of rats in California that never saw their grandchildren. I'm sorry.
Oh, dear. No, they had vets there checking out the rats.
I don't think they did. I think this was in an era that if you'd done that today, someone would have screamed bloody
murder. Oh, they wouldn't. I'm sure they would not. You can't even distress animals. It doesn't matter about sort of killing them. These days, you can't even distress them. I had a shot.
You tried to drown a rat?
Were you drowning rats again?
I've told
with,
you about that,
no, with a fish. And just had to sort of take it out of the water and have it flapping, but we weren't allowed to do it because that would be in distress. And it was something to do with the fact that the fish, if it had a backbone, then it became categorized as, something other than just, a life form that was not worth worrying about. So thus we couldn't do it, and you had to get, animatronic.
How do you do fly spray ads where you kill flies and kill cockroaches?
I guess they're animated these days, isn't it? So cartoons, happy, funny cartoons, and the flies just go and die because people don't mind dying in cartoons.
Even though the purpose of the product is to kill things.
Absolutely stone dead things, absolutely.
I have this thing that will kill rats, but I'm not allowed to show a rat dying on the counter that I don't want to distress the rat. But the purpose of the rat-killing product is to kill rats.
Yeah, okay. People like rats these days. You walk past a pet shop, there's rats in it.
Moving along. what do we think of the actual aliens, the miniatures and the puppet
the
work
NTIs?
Stan Winston did?
Bloody fantastic.
Yeah, they did absolutely have wonderful.
Awesome. Beautiful. Wonderful. Don't you think?
Go, KM?
Yes, I think they're absolutely wonderful. They're just amazing.
They did have a deep sea feel to them, didn't they?
Yes.
Yeah, clearly that whole sort of bioluminescence thing and the whole fiber optic was wonderful with Perspex and fiber optics. You could make something that did feel organic and did feel sort of alien, yet underwater at the same time. They looked fantastic, and you got emotion from them. You got, you've really felt empathy for them, and for something that is really special effects, it never really took me out of the film.
So let me be semi-negative for a second, because this film was made in the 80s. Were there shots that you thought didn't stand up today?
Well, jumping ahead, the wave a little bit, some of the matting in the wave. But when I look back, when I researched a little bit more how they did it, it was pretty impressive how they did the wave.
Sure.
Again, that is jumping ahead a little bit. But I think
that's... Jump at will.
Okay. Well, so for the extended version, they added in this impressive scene of people running in terror from the beach as massive 200-foot-high waves are about to... crash over cities and essentially the NTIs showing that they're showing their power, and I think they built like about a 60 or 30 foot wide massive model of a wave, and it was manipulated and moving with motion control motors, and they added a little bit just to sort of give it a bit of life. They added optically just a little bit of spray to the top of the wave, because what you notice is that it's just, even though the wave is cresting and it's frozen there, there's still a little bit of movement to it, and there's still a little bit of spray on the top, which really adds life. But down the bottom, it really just doesn't mat and key into all the people running along the beach. It really doesn't sort of sit in there properly at all. So that sort of takes away a little bit of the power of that scene for me.
Kristen, what about you?
I would agree about the waves. It just didn't quite sell it for me. There was a couple shots of the NTIs that were not quite as convincing, like through today's eyes. But for the most part, I think that everything with the fiber optics and the glows and everything were just wonderful. And the big ship, just really great. The other thing that I didn't like when the ship comes out of the water, it's just like, oh, that's it's not so great in light of day.
The Benthic Explorer being on the massive NTI's arc thing coming out
right.
of the water.
Yeah, the okay. way that it looked in the light of day, it was just like, okay, ho hum.
Yeah. Well, what amazed me is there's a little bit of drop off the depth of field, which is a bit of a giveaway, because obviously if you're trying to say something is, you know, 200 foot long, you know,
and the rest,
explorer
yeah.
ship, everything should be sharp. But there was a little bit of sort of drop off with, but you get that with film, when, you know, obviously when you're cranking out, you know, 120, you know, 200 frames a second. But the model itself was absolutely massive. You know, the Benthic Explorer model was like 42 foot long or so.
Weighed 7 tons. It was 1/10 scale, that sucker.
I'm not sure if that was the same model that was on the NTI arc that came out of the water at the end.
That's a good question. I don't know about that.
Theoretically, they did build one of the biggest ocean-going or water-going models that's ever been done.
Well,
42-foot long, 16-foot wide.
They couldn't do digital waves because this is pre-digital water.
Right.
So
right.
to get... And, I mean, waves are the hardest thing to scale. So they had to make huge miniatures and actually drag them out to sea and film them in real water.
Yeah, they did a pretty good job.
Which leads me to the only shot that I sort of went is kind of hokey by today's standards, was when the hurricane was coming in, and just before they lost the crane down the hole,
yeah,
they had a couple of shots of, the bridge and the captain outside, and he walked in, and it was just such a kind of rear projection-y kind of look.
It was rear projected in the stage, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And... you know, today you'd have just done digital waves and stuff, but you can't do that, obviously, back then. So you had to just shoot some stuff and try and comp it in, and that was a hard sell. And I bet, you know, had I or anyone else been around at the time, you wouldn't have been able to do any better, but it was just one of those classic cases where it was a real limitation. You can't, you know, fake out being in a huge gale with a ship like that, because you can't film in a huge gale like that. So
no, you can't rely on it. Even when they took the model of the Benthic Explorer, the big twin-hulled exploration vessel, out into storms and, you know, shot this massive miniature towing it through the most amazing storms you've ever seen with fog, you know, with fog machines, and it was deemed not... It was some of the biggest squalls they've ever been in that had ever been reported in that area. The footage was still deemed to be not stormy enough, and they had to go back to the drawing board.
At the other end of the spectrum, shots that I think worked surprisingly well given the simple nature of them. One of the ones that I remember at the time thinking, how the heck did they do that, was the parting of the Red Sea water, as it were, in the ship at the end with Ed Harris's character about to take his helmet off and breathe air and eject the water from his lungs.
When he is sitting inside the NTI's ship and he's got a wall of water on the left and right of him?
Right.
Yep,
exactly.
Right.
Yep.
And the wall of water separating.
Oh, it was impressive. Really, really good. I kept looking, where's the mat line? I kept looking for it.
Do you know how they did it?
Well, they had a set maybe that they rotated 90 degrees and then 180 and did two water level passes and then leveled
it. Split-screen them. You are a director. You know how to do these things.
Excellent.
But yes, that's exactly what they did. But I thought it worked really, really well. Excellent. They had a stunt actor sort of nailed to the floor and then tipped the whole thing on its side lowered it up and down through the water, which gave you the vertical wall of water. But then to sell the effect, you had to have the other wall. So
exactly.
They flipped it the other way. Camera, of course, being nailed to the rig. So whichever way you tilted the rig, it didn't appear any different to the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And then you lifted it out of the water the other way. And what you got was lifting out of the water, left of screen is, you know, the B take. Lifting out water on the right side of screen with the actor is your A take. You split screen them together because the camera was locked off the whole time, and at an interesting kind of odd angle.
For quite a simple sequence, there's a lot to it, and you've got the NTIs
didn't it look
themselves,
good though, when
the NTI
that wall of water separates.
Yeah, you've got the text projected on the water. There's a lot in there, which I've still no idea how it was done, which is fabulous because you just get involved in that scene. I think it, you know, it's possibly, you know, a little bit daggy with the whole, you know, love you wife thing, which is a little bit
well
sort of,
you know, the other shot that
the
I thought
screen,
was really cool was when the wife touched the underwater stuff when she was out on herself earlier on in the film. You know, she's out, it
yes,
comes up and she
the
touches
manta,
it.
The huge NTI manta ray thing.
Yeah.
Yes. And she is obviously reacting to nothing, as she says it. Essentially that shot, even though she's just standing there reacting to nothing, putting a hand out to nothing, that's like, that one shot was a day.
But so you know what was really cool about that? Shot. And I'll confess this. I didn't even notice it until I read how they did it. And then I went back and noticed it. Is that they have the perfect reflection of her hand in the right. alien because they put a piece of silver mylar reflective surface in. So when they were filming her, obviously against her, because it was composite,
right.
they actually got the reflection of her arm. So if you look carefully, you can see her perfect reflection coming in the other way to touch it. And obviously that, you know, helped sell the shot, though I'm such a dork, I didn't even notice that.
But again, also it's awesome because of Mary Elizabeth's reaction to it. The beautiful light.
The light play. The
light. I've got a shout out to Michael Salomon's fantastic lighting. Awesome, beautifully shot. It looks brilliant. Even, you know, today it just looks
Now, this was
fantastic.
About the time of HMIs coming in, right?
Yeah, so obviously they've got, huge developments in underwater lighting to have, underwater HMIs. It really is quite hard to light underwater. You're trying to project through a substance that is cutting down your light much more dramatically than it is topside. So
you don't really think about the evolution of lighting the way we think about the evolution of visual effects. But I mean, around this time, they were using incandescent lighting, which was incredibly inefficient for its ability to throw light, which, of course, you need a hell of a lot of light.
Back in the old days of, arc lights.
Yeah, but this was the HMI. Because when I entered the industry, HMIs were kind of old hat, and we were all getting excited about kinoflows and stuff, and they're now excited about LED light panels. But HMI lighting was a pretty big, development. Certainly it changed the colour temperature and moved stuff to a more efficient kind of...
Yeah.
Still sucked a hell of a lot of power, though. You
entered a whole world of pain of HMI flicker and...
HMI flicker, yes.
HMI flicker and shutter speeds and all that sort of hell.
And yet...
But the globes lasted a hell of a lot longer. Absolutely. The pain before then to get that much light was arc lights, which was just absolutely crazy.
You get like
two huge rods
of
carbons with a massive spark. It's just horrific.
And about 80% of the bloody waste would just be the heat that would put off by those sort of heaters.
And of course, that's kind of, you could never have lit anything underwater before without HMIs, arc lights and underwater. Two technologies maybe that wouldn't have worked too well together. But as I say, the NTI, that Manta, that's a beautiful model as well. Model, it's like a bigature, massive, beautiful, again, beautifully made fiber optic masterpiece.
But it's pretty good with the lighting was superb. I say pretty good, friggin' awesome. Yeah. In the fact that they did keep it so dark, they did keep it like there wasn't lots of ambient light around, which of course there wouldn't be.
Yeah.
Which, presents its own problems. And obviously there are a few unmotivated lights in there just to make it play. But
yeah, sure.
It was still pretty bloody good. And I tell you the other thing I really loved and remember thinking at the time was the coolest trick ever when I read about it in Cinefix. Big plug again for Cinefix issue 39. Is that they had projectors in the mini subs so that when the actors were giving the performance of sitting there moving rods and dials and adjusting tilt and tiller, in fact, that was just projected 35 on a tiny little projector inside the miniature. So what you were seeing was a comp in camera, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so essentially every time you see like Mary Elizabeth inside Cab 3 or the smaller smaller
wasn't
subs.
Wasn't able to go with the cowgirl hat.
She was cool. Yeah, she's got an unusual name.
Except for the one line where she says, talk to him. No, talk to him.
Yeah. That's a bit
apart from that line, it was really cool.
We'll forgive that.
Yeah.
Talk to me, Jace. No, really, mate. Talk to me. What was going on?
Daggy. That was the awesome scene of Mary, of...
Ed Harris's character dying, not dying.
No,
but I'm
Mary
saying get back to the projector thing.
Oh, yeah. Yes, every time you see her in the interior of the cab one or cab three, the smaller subs, you see her at the controls. The sub is a miniature, but rather than keying or matting in pre-shot stuff on the stage or on the one-to-one sub of Mary Elizabeth operating the sub, there is actually a small projector made from a modified 35mm stills camera. So essentially, it is take a stills camera and put rather than a roll of film, put a roll of film that you've already pre-shot, essentially, a print put a light behind it, and in the front of the miniature, they've got a small circular projector screen. So it's actually this little rear projected, motion controlled projector made from a modified stills camera. So every time so literally, not only do you have the miniature itself is being motion controlled through the set. But also the motion control is controlling the printer, so the projector rather inside the model. So it's in camera, all of those that sort of shot. So it's essentially a little baby Mary Elizabeth inside the miniature. It blows me away. Outstanding.
Yes. So
nothing you'd have to worry about these days.
I know. Cam, anything else that just struck you as being really cool when you watched it?
I'm going to veer off the visual effects for a second, just into the sound design. I thought was really amazing, especially after the disaster on the Deep Core, when they've slid further underwater, and there's all the sound design of all the groans and the
crashing sub and creaking hulls.
The hull crushing and the dripping and all that sort of thing. And there's a particular scene when Ed Harris is sneaking up on Coffee, and he's got that chain, but he's like messing with that chain, and it's just like it's such a great, you have that where he's far away and then he comes up closer, and it's just like so menacing. I really enjoyed that.
Half the movie.
I must point out that Cam is the only person qualified to talk about audio, as she's actually like fully trained and understands audio, whereas Jason and I are completely stupid when it comes to this.
Go, oh, cool sound.
But it's a very good point, actually. I hadn't even thought about that, but it was superb. And the use of that sonar ping, which just says everything, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Something approaching. That's the dun 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 of the
movie. Right, the start
of the
movie.
The aliens approaching on the,
We didn't discuss the sub.
I know. I was just thinking. We didn't even go over it all. The Montana, the scenes on the Montana.
Yeah, well, that was what I was going to say. Yeah, the whole dry set, massive miniatures of the USS Montana, which was essentially all done dry set with controlled smoke and motion control passes, and essentially some of the most amazing shots are the crashed Montana. Sitting there on the rock ledge, where you've got all Cab 1 and Cab 2 and all the little rovers all flying over it. When you look at, you see behind the scenes for that sort of stuff, and essentially you've got, first of all, you've got a dry set where to have atmospheric sort of perspective haze underwater rather than sort of putting in later, you've got controlled smoke that needs to stay exactly the same as it is for motion control patches, which were essentially 12-hour long shots.
Wow.
They'd set the shot and then go away overnight and come back, and a few shots were actually ruined because people would actually come in in the morning and open the door and the shot's still going and they've opened doors on these things,
but if the smoke moves, it flickers.
Yeah, but you're looking at a motion control rig for the camera to actually do the camera move, but then also in a massive gantry above, you've got three or four gimbals, all motion controlled, all puppeteering the other little baby ships across the Montana, and you've got controlled smoke that needs to be, obviously, the level of that needs to be topped up over 12 hours without any flickering or notice in change of exposure. It's just, my brain just hurts just thinking of how you get it looking so good.
Well, to finish up this week, I'll say that in the words of Lindsay, we all see what we want to see. Coffee looks and he sees Russians. He sees fear and hate. We look and we see bloody good visual effects.
Absolutely.
KM, where can people find you?
Let's see. I'm on the Twitter, Kristen C. Martin. And, of course, we have the Twitter account for the show, VFX Show. So it's a good idea to follow that. And you can also send suggestions. We always love to hear suggestions. So that's...
Absolutely.
Pretty much it for me.
And Jace?
Probably Twitter. Twitter.com/Wingrove.
Who thought that when I went straight for the warhead, it was cute. Sorry.
What?
It's all right.
and also you can catch Mike and I on Red Center podcast about digital cinematography, Red camera, filmmaking in general, post-production. FXGuide.com.
FX Guide's the home of the Red Center podcast.
Yep, and my website, jasonwingrove.com.
And you can find me at FX Guide or at FX PhD, and I'm also on the Twitters as Mike Seymour. Guys, thanks so much for listening. KM, thanks for joining us via satellite. I'd like to say that, but it's not really. And Jace, actually by underwater sea cable, probably, yes. To tell you the honest truth. And Jace, thank you for just, you know, basically coming in here to the office, really.
Thank you. Look, it's great to get the opportunity to see these films again, pull them out of the drawer, and it's fantastic.
It is funny, you know, like you go to see these films. Sometimes when we go The Abyss, I go, well, I've seen that. And I think, well, it's maybe a bit of an effort to sit down and watch this because, you know, I've seen it several hundred times already. And, you know, you just think, well, I should look at it again because, you know, I'm doing it for the story, blah, blah, blah. And you start watching it and it's engrossing. And you just think, my memory just completely, oh, yeah, that bit, oh, that's great. I completely forgot about that.
Because I'm sort of starting to relive a lot of these films through my kids now. I sort of pull them out and say, well, you guys have got to watch this. And there's a couple I've pulled out and I've gone, they've just gone, Dad, this is lame. But yes, this one,
no
this one did not.
Span.
Well, there's a lot of films that
somewhere
do not stand up.
Somewhere a VFX artist loses its wings.
But this film is definitely the exception. It holds up fantastically well and can maintain the interest of 13-year-olds.
Yeah, and just complete green with envy over Strapinus actually hanging out with Cameron doing the new... Yes, though we will look forward to that film like no other. Obviously when Avatar comes out. Okay,
yeah, will we be covering that one?
We'll definitely cover that one.
But who should we get to talk about it, though?
I wonder. Well, okay, thanks so much, guys. We'll talk to you next week. See ya.
See ya.
Bye.